Just a reminder that this service is being recorded, and the entire service will be available on the password protected member page on our website. We kindly ask that no photos be taken during today's presentation, as has been requested by the guest speaker. Our prelude this morning is Whirlwind OP 141 by Cornelius Gerlich, performed by Tuppence Van Varst. Tuppence. Again, my name is Molly. Oh. I'm Molly Plunkett. I am a longtime member of Prairie, and every time I have to do this, I have to think, how long has it been? Longer than my youngest child, so it seems like at least 30 years. I have been involved with the Social Action Committee at Prairie for many years with Pam Gates and Chris Porter and Millie Moffitt and others. I'm on the board right now, and am here today because I was instrumental in helping to find our speaker for today. So we welcome all of you to our service, especially those of you who are searching for a spiritual home. Many of us were once, too, seeking for something larger than ourselves to which we could belong, a sense of rootedness to hold us as we create meaning together. We do that well here, though not perfectly. In this congregation, we strive not for perfection, but for authenticity and connection. Whether it's your first time with us or your 100th time, we hope you'll find here questions that stretch you, people to befriend you, and values that challenge you to join us in loving boldly, living justly, and welcoming openly. Our chalice lighting this morning, reading for that will be done by Margaret Moser.
Good morning. My name is Margaret Moses. My pronouns are she, her, hers. If another strains to breathe, may our voices be the gentle rise and fall. If another chokes on tears, may our voices be an opening to hope. If another has forgotten, may our voices be a memory upwelling. If another is adrift, may our voices be the calling of community.
Thanks, Margaret. So our opening music is in the Gray Hymnal, number 131, Love Will Guide Us, which we will be accompanied on by Tuppence. Please stand as you are able, in body or spirit.
Thank you.
Nice job. So our next event is The Story for All Ages, which is Can You Hear the Plants Speak?, written by Nicholas Hummingbird, illustrated by Madeline Goodnight, and read by Jesse Garst. So all the kids and adults are welcome to come down to the front and hear Jesse read this story. After the story, we will sing our kids out. The lyrics are in the order of service.
All right, great. Oh, yep, I can hear it now. Okay. So, I'm Jesse, my pronouns are they, them. And this is Can You Hear the Plants Speak? By Nicholas Hummingbird with Julia Wasson, illustrations by Madeline Goodnight. Our people believe spirit lives in everything. Mountain, river, wind, tree. Come take a walk with me. I spent long summer days with my great-grandparents exploring every rock and plant, learning when the creeks ran and the plants flowered. I chased squirrels, played with lizards. Wind sang through the bunch grass. Woodpecker tapped his heartbeat. Leaves danced across the ground. We listened as our plant relatives spoke. Wild strawberries said, "We'll quench your thirst when the streams run dry." Buckwheat said, "Birds eat my seeds, and so can you." White sage said, "My smoke will lift your prayers to heaven." We rested in Grandfather Oak's shade. These trees are our ancestors. They give us our food, our medicine, our connection to spirit, my great-grandparents explained. And we thank them with a song, a blessing, a few drops of water. I sprinkled great cool water as my great-grandparents quietly hummed an ancient song. I felt their song inside me. But not everyone could hear plants speak. Some people thought our lands would be more useful flattened in concrete. The land was silenced. I grew up and the city grew too. When my great-grandparents passed, I lost their voices. Adrift, I was lost too. But wait, who is this? Monarch at rest on milkweed emerging through a crack. Milkweed scent whispered, "Don't give up." I remembered my great-grandparents' voices singing in the shade of Grandfather Oak. "Thank you, brother," I whispered. I had to find a way to keep their voices alive. But the cities were so big, the natural places so few. What could one person do? I listened. A drop of rain splashed in the dry dust where thirsty seeds waited. That one drop might germinate one seed. One drop, then many. The sharp scent of creosote rose. I felt the seeds drink. I knew what to do. "Thank you," I whispered to the sky and the plants. From one, I would grow many. I had so much to learn. You want to see the next page, Pippin? Plants became my best teachers. Black Walnut said, "Gather our hard, round shells and chill us for the winter." Poppy said, "Shake our seeds into baskets as winds scatter them." Juncus said, "Divide our stems after fledglings leave their nests." Lupin said, "We carpet the hillsides. Our seed coats are broken by a tumble of rock." Palo Verde said, "My seeds pass through raven's stomachs, soften me with acid." And Manzanita said, "We bloom after wildfire, wake our seeds with a wisp of smoke." And then my son is born. I name him Tuhui, our word for the drop of rain that starts the seed. We draw strength from wind and mountain, bobcat and hummingbird, bringing life to our home in the city. We grow plants for all our relatives. Each new seedling is a healing. Tiny neighbors, check them out. Grow strong, little guys. You're the hope of so many. We plant empty places. This is how we give back. These oaks will shade our grandchildren, I explain, just as my great-grandparents had explained to me. Can you hear the plants speak? I ask Tuhui. Yes. What do they tell you?
Let's listen to the plants.
They say thank you. And the song grows in him, in me, and maybe in you. Listen, can you hear it? What's what? It's trees, probably. I think that's what you're pointing at. And that is the end of this book.
Nice choice. So we'll be singing Our Youth Out. The lyrics are in the order of service. Neglected earlier to mention my pronouns are she, her. So I am going to read a meditation today rather than having our full moment of silence as we often do. You can close your eyes for this or not. So the meditation is called Fall Equinox by Lori Gorgas Hyben. Lobbin. I guess Ralph knows. Okay. Balanced in the center between the longest and the shortest days, a gold light leaf is held, suspended by the delicate green needles on an evergreen tree. Equinox. The wheel of the year turns and turns again. The cool air cools, days shorten. The sun seems to weaken, barely clearing the horizon after rising before beginning its descent. This is our opportunity now to pause. Balanced. Breathing in. Breathing out. Knowing this present moment. This present moment is all we are guaranteed. Like the sun, moving toward the shortest day, each movement arises and is gone before we know it. This is the time to pause and consider. As we enter the season of contemplation, of increasing darkness, and of lying fallow, of dormancy. This is the season of letting go, of lightening burdens, of preparing for a long period, of being still, going deep. Pause and consider. Binaries, dark and light, hot and cold, chaos and order. Neither extreme is inherently good or bad. It is all a matter of balance, of honoring the spectrum for which binaries mark the endpoints. Today we mark the midpoint between summer and the winter solstice, a time to seek balance and be free. Blessed be. Our presentation today is What We Can Learn from Indigenous Farming, and is presented to us by Daniel Hayden. Daniel is a doctorate candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. He is an enrolled citizen of the Comanche Nation. His research focuses on collaborations with tribal growers to help implement organic practices with their traditional crops. Outside of research, Daniel enjoys gardening with his wife, Amber, and relaxing with their cat, Poi? Pui. Please welcome Daniel, who's already made, of course, a connection, an Oklahoma connection with Ron Fry.
All right, can everyone hear me? Is this good? Okay, I'm gonna take this off also. I practiced talking with the mask, but it's hard. Thank you very much for having me. I actually, from Norman, Oklahoma, one of my good friends growing up, his family was in the Unitarian, group essentially. So I would actually go there a lot of times during weekends. So I actually was very nice getting this opportunity to come back basically. So, I'm a grad student in UW-Madison, Department of Plant Pathology. I think it's my last year, hopefully. At least my funding runs out next year, so I'm looking for jobs now. But I think the overall, what I do for my research, we think of plant pathology, it's historically been the study of how diseases like viruses, bacteria, and fungi impact, commercial crops, and that's sort of been the norm. It's getting a little more looser today with how we sort of view, a lot of the interactions between plants and microbes differently now as opposed to back then. And so I'm somehow in this department. I work with the organic extension agent at UW-Madison, so that's sort of how I got into this department. I have to take all the plant pathology tests and everything, so I guess I have to call myself that. So my research, I think, overall asked this question, I think, what can we learn from indigenous farming? When I'm talking about that, I mean specifically here in North America, because we know, there have been many crops domesticated here in North America. People have been living here for centuries. So what exactly was going on and what's going on right now, essentially, and how can we better inform our current farming agricultural decisions off what has been done before on these very same lands, which sort of makes sense, I think. I'm trying to use the clicker. All right, let's do next. Oh, okay, worked, cool. All right, so I guess the first question we can ask is, what is indigenous farming? Of course, when I write about this, I'm very broad and I guess when indigenous people grow crops, which seems like a very unanimous, everyone can agree on that, not very, scholarly debate about that, I think. But first I think is describing what crops. So we know that here in North America for centuries, crops like corn, beans, squash, melons, sunflowers, tomatoes, potatoes, a bunch of them have been domesticated here and grown here. So many of the crops that we still eat today and still are, other cultures across the world utilized heavily for their cuisines were domesticated here in North America. And I think it's important to note that, these crops and a lot of the varieties that originally were domesticated are still around today, and many of them are still being grown today as well. So that's part of it. And then another question we can ask too is, how do indigenous peoples farm? If you ever go to Carroll College at Waukesha on the way to Milwaukee, on their college, you can still see it today, actually. They have corn mounds, so mounds of soil that are where they grew corn. And I think they still have their graduations and stuff on this field, and it's really bumpy, but that's, it's the evidence is, here in Wisconsin. I was trying to find the image, but it was really low quality. I couldn't find the original report, but up in Menominee up north, there's these pictures from the 20s and 30s of these ridges of fields, of these raised bed fields. And you can literally see these ridges, and they would go in every, 10 years and just add more matter and soil onto the field. So you get these raised beds. So of course, Wisconsin now has a rich history of agriculture, but it's always, it's the idea of it's always been a good place to grow crops, and people grow crops here now and they've always grown crops here before. And I think it's also important to make this difference, so indigenous farming, how is that different from, today's mainstream, what we call conventional farming? And it's often, I think, what we call traditional farming. So, you know, we still see it a lot in many countries around the world where it's more subsistence based, you know, feeding your families, communities, as opposed to the majority of what we see here is, you know, growing for, you know, money and, you know, commodity crops such as corn and soybeans. So there's that difference there. And because of that, you know, it's more of that community or like family effort essentially. So a lot of manual labor as opposed to reliance on machinery. That's, you know, there's many people that still farm crops around the world that don't utilize machinery. And, but that's, you know, of course, very, it requires a community, requires a group. You know, my wife and I have a plot at Eagle Heights and it's hard. It's definitely very difficult to drive out there like every other day and check on stuff, raccoons, rain. It's very difficult. But I think also something to note that I noted to earlier was, you know, seed saving, this idea of these heirloom crop varieties being, you know, saved through generations. And, you know, if you go online or read the news, any sort of, you know, what we have the notion now of like, you know, seeds and, you know, GM, genetically modified organisms and companies owning seed, it's a very controversial, you know, subject, even for the farmers growing the seed as well. You know, it's very driven by, you know, capitalism and like, you know, what the companies and the research is wanting to do. And I think another important thing to note too, as I mentioned right here, is oftentimes traditional agriculture, you know, since you're not using those big machinery, you're relying more on natural alterations to the soil. And that's what these corn mounds are right here, essentially. Up here in Wisconsin, by mounding and making ridges of soil, you're creating an optimal temperature. And that's been, there's been lots of research about, like, you know, why were they making mounds? Why were they making ridges? And, you know, it's a very practical reason behind it, because it grew, it was able to maintain better temperature and better to drain easily for corn. So that's the reason why. And then something that I think we all are maybe a little more familiar with is this idea of intercropping, where because you're not relying on machinery, you know, pesticides or chemicals, you have to almost rely on the natural processes of how organisms naturally interact. And I think a good example of that is what we know today as the Three Sisters, which utilizing the three main crops that were grown, that were domesticated in here in North America or Central America, which is corn, beans, and squash. And I mean, it's, I think we hear it a lot today. If you look online, you'll see a lot of resources about it. It's a very unanimous sort of practice that's been occurring for the past, you know, 1,000 years, essentially. You know, if you go up to the Northeast, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy in New York and the Great Lakes region practiced it. If you go down to the Southwest, the Pueblo also practiced this similar practice, where essentially you're working with how these, they were able to figure out these crops grow very well together and in these different environments too. And I think the main takeaway is that, you know, this reliance on, you know, the connection between, you know, natural interactions between organisms, because, you know, this was being done productively for hundreds of years, for centuries. And, you know, there was no tillage working up the soil. There was no chemical pesticides or herbicides. And there's been, you know, historical accounts from explorers and even like recreations done by modern day agronomists to say that this is very productive. And, you know, there's lots of research and literature that says that growing multiple crops together is oftentimes better than just growing just one. If you go on the highway and drive, you'll see just a field of just corn, a field of just soybean. That's, you know, it's, and that's, I'll get into that later, but that's for a lot of reasons. And essentially, I think what's important here is, you know, each crop has its purpose. The corn is the main carbohydrate, but also provides a structure for the beans. The beans are that protein source, but also add that nitrogen to the soil over a long term. And then finally, the squash at the bottom, I've heard multiple things, shading out the soil for weeds, although I don't know about that one. I might not be doing it right. And then also, I've heard also too, the thorniness of the leaves is bad for raccoons. I must not have the right ones then, because the raccoons still attack my stuff consistently. But yeah, so essentially there is a, you know, this is all done by hand, essentially. You're out there, you're doing this by hand. That's the garden that my wife and I have out at Eagle Heights. We have lots of mounds of three sisters, and you have to make the mounds by hand. You have to plant everything at the correct time. You have to weed constantly. And I think there's a really big push right now in Wisconsin, especially of, you know, in tribal nations looking to reclaim a lot of the practices, crops and foods that were originally, you know, abundant here, or originally trying to preserve or increase the amount. And that's sort of, I think, where my work comes into play, because, you know, because we, when we think of indigenous farming, we may think of Three Sisters, but we have to understand, you know, obviously indigenous people are still here and still adapting and trying different things to, you know, grow their traditional variety of crops, which is why, you know, that's why I define indigenous farming as indigenous people doing farming, because it doesn't have to be a certain way and it's very broad. But at the same time, there's a lot of ongoing efforts to increase and preserve traditional food ways. So the work that I do, specifically, I work with a lot of the tribal nonprofits, tribal governments, and like community groups who are looking, their goal is to increase the amount of corn. They might have the traditional variety of corn. And obviously, a whole even like more than an acre of Three Sisters mounds is probably not very feasible. I mean, even just my own experience, you know, I can only make it out to the garden probably 3 times a week on a good week if things aren't busy, or, you know, my wife and I have other obligations. And I'm sure if we had to coordinate between this whole room, that would be even more chaotic. We all have our own obligations, our own things going on in our lives. And so that's the same for them. So they approached our research group, and they were asking, we are interested in expanding, but we want to obviously do it more sustainably. We don't want to fall into the normal pitfalls of, you know, using chemicals, of working up the soil, because a lot of the soils have already been, you know, damaged over long-term use from like non-indigenous stewardship. And so, and this poster sort of is like a testament to that. It's one of the groups that I work with, and we had a field day last year because we had a really bad drought last year. And despite all that, we really worked with them. We've been working with this group for like 4 years on, you know, this practice of these organic practices, and it turned out really well, actually. And so we were able to share with people from the university, people from the community, about the success, because the whole idea is that we're trying to, you know, understand many of these organic practices a little better, essentially, because, to be honest, you know, we see a lot of farming. Farming's not seen as a very net positive output for the land, essentially. And because of that, it's harder to get more, we can just say, oh, they should use more sustainable practices. I mean, it's easier said than done to figure out the practice and also convince farmers to do said practice. So that's sort of where we fit in this whole sort of process right now. And so what I specifically do is we on the left, we have, you know, the Three Sisters. That's sort of what I was introducing earlier. And as I mentioned before, each crop has its purpose. Each crop does a certain job, essentially. There's research saying that stuff like Three Sisters and intercropping, you can reduce your diseases, essentially, reduce the amount of pests you have, increase soil health over time. So we were working with these tribal groups and trying to understand how can we, you know, do something very analogous on a like larger scale. And there's this practice called using cover crops, and which is often done in farming, usually when you have your crop of corn, and then you'll harvest, and then you can usually lay down what's called a cover crop at the end of the season, and that just essentially provides cover for the soil throughout like the fallow season, like winter through the spring, essentially, where the soil is being covered. It's not being hit by winds that make it cause erosion. It's not losing organic matter throughout the season. And you can see it a few times here in the winter. It's still not a very, in Wisconsin, it's very hard to do because the shorter growing season. Essentially, if you like, farmers have to harvest their corn at the same time. They have to coordinate getting their machines and everything ready to plant the cover crops. So it's not done very often up here. We're trying to get that more, but it's still difficult. But an alternative to that is, well, if they have trouble planting the cover crop like later in the season, let's just do it earlier in the season. So that's sort of this practice called interseeding cover crops that we've been trying to understand. And it functions very similarly to the Three Sisters, because you have multiple crops being essentially grown together during the season. And that's sort of, they were very excited about this, because it presented an opportunity to, you know, for them to grow these traditional crops at a larger scale, essentially. They're able to, you know, enter markets, sell their produce, but also feed their communities as well, and also increase the amount of seed that they have. So, let's see. And yeah, I think it's sort of, it's like this, it's like mixture of both, you know, our modern sustainable ideas and, you know, this traditional knowledge that we're working with them on how to implement, because unfortunately, you know, a lot of, there's been, you know, a systematic effort to, you know, exclude indigenous people from, you know, the resources such as the USDA and other like African American farmers as well, farmers of color. And then there's also, I mean, access to land's a big issue as well. And so there's a lot of things that we're working with this research, but essentially we're really just trying to, you know, directly work with indigenous growers and what efforts they want to do and trying to just, you know, help them solve their goals, basically help them get there, because they don't really, there's not a lot of resources for them, but we're working on that. We're trying to at least at the university level, trying to, you know, make sure their perspectives are heard. And with that sort of there, I've been doing this for a while. I was actually in the field yesterday in Oneida in Green Bay harvesting cover crop. I'm still kind of sore, but it's made me sort of think, so we have an example here where we're combining, you know, efforts. You know, indigenous growers have their ideas and their values, and, you know, the modern organic movement has their, you know, practices and ideas. And like, how can we work together on this? But then also it made me think more, how can we, you know, broader inform farming as a whole, essentially? And I think it's important to note, you know, there's several reasons why indigenous farming is important. The first one that I mentioned earlier was that, you know, there is a vast amount of heirloom seed varieties out there that are still being preserved, still being grown. And the thing is with, you know, modern day crops, you know, they're very big, they're very nice looking, but that's all come as, you know, it's a trade-off essentially. Years of breeding has essentially, plant genetics is super complicated. So whenever you're breeding for size or color, you're losing just as many traits each generation. And, you know, that's why they say like the heirloom varieties are healthier for you, because they haven't lost a lot of those nutrition, a lot of those other aspects. And, you know, there's even more thought about what if crops before were more resistant to disease? What if they were better to compete with other crops better? What if they were able to utilize nutrients better? So there's like a lot of questions that were, you know, modern crop scientists are asking now. And there's a vast resource right here that is capable of answering a lot of those questions and almost shifting how we think about crops, because now we're still breeding crops for the same system, essentially. It's like, oh, there's a drought, let's get a drought-resistant variety in there. But that's, you're still, you know, droughts are still going to come, and you're going to have the diseases are still going to come. So there's, I think, a really good resource here for, you know, science to really look at. And of course it has to be done respectfully, because these crops, these seeds are sacred. They're integral to a lot of stories and cultural knowledge. So there has to first be, you know, a establishment of, you know, regulation and understanding, which hasn't really occurred yet, but it's something that we're currently working on. And yeah, and it's, I think it's a vast resource that could be utilized better. And then something else that's interesting as well is, you know, I mean, like my mom gardening, she did like intercropping multiple crops. I'm sure people here know that as well. It's a lot of farming research is, well, it works. We don't really know how, but it sort of works essentially. So the issue is there have been years since the 1960s and 50s of really hard research and optimization for what we see out there in the, like, you know, the cornfields and soybean fields out on the highway. There's been years and millions of dollars of investment to, you know, really optimize these cropping systems to be, you know, uniform, to where they're harvested easier, to, you know, work with the fertilizers and pesticides and chemicals that we're putting in with them. And that's fine and all, but, you know, we haven't really invested that time and research into understanding, you know, how this works on a, like, really mechanism scale, because we know it works, but it's like, how? We don't know. And I think it's important to note that, you know, there's, with these, you know, when we ask the question, why can't farming be more sustainable? Well, we know it can, but it just literally, there isn't enough research and resources being put into those more sustainable options for us to convince farmers to take that option, essentially. You know, how can this practice work here and another place, essentially, as opposed to just working really well here, and then once it fails another place, they're not going to use it. So it's a lot of, you know, it's unfortunate, because I'm reading this book right now about intercropping, he's growing multiple crops, and it's written like in the late 80s, and the guy's like, oh, maybe one day, you know, we'll have crops that will breed crops that can grow well together, and we'll build actual machinery that can harvest multiple crops at once. That hasn't even happened really yet. We're still stuck in this current system that we're currently in, essentially. And I think we know that there are practices that can better take care of or have a better impact on land. It's just we can see right here through centuries of the use of these three crops right here. We just have to actually, you know, invest resources into understanding how it actually works, like how we have with the other ways we're doing things. And then also, I think another important thing is the cultural knowledge that's associated with indigenous farming. You know, there's the seeds and the crops and the practices are all associated with, you know, songs, dances, language, stories. And I've talked to many, you know, indigenous farmers across the country, and that seems to be sort of the main thing, where there's always this, you know, there's this deep connection to crops. And I think if I had to put it like in a very like basic, like sort of way I can even explain it myself, is, you know, it's farming is this connection to land where, you know, you're to take care of it and to reap the gifts, you have to, like, you know, sort of maintain this positive impact on land overall. And I think that's, you hear indigenous people talk about, you know, eight generations. That's sort of always been that long-term thinking. And I think where our current farming is, it's, you know, very short-term thinking in terms of, like, you know, what works well this year, profit, you know, getting high amounts of yield. And I think there's a lot we can learn from that, obviously. And this is at the garden at Eagle Heights. My wife, she's Navajo from New Mexico, and this is how they grow corn in like the spiral. I think I forgot the reason why, but I'll have to ask her again. But essentially, though, but I mean, there's like certain obviously cultural practices and norms, and, you know, it's all sort of connected. It's very integral to culture, and like that's why this work's been, not gonna say difficult, but a little more, you know, we have to be very careful, because we're working with culturally significant crops. We're working with culturally significant knowledge that we're being entrusted to, you know, understand and, you know, collaborate and work with. So that's sort of, I think, why, you know, myself as an indigenous person, why I'm sort of able to be this middleman between the university researchers and, you know, the tribal farming groups, and sort of act as like the intermediary, because I'm a scientist myself, I'm a plant scientist, so I'm able to sort of help sort of negotiate and, you know, understand what needs to be done, essentially. And, you know, again, sort of looking at this big picture idea of, you know, our current agricultural systems. And, you know, I've watched this like PBS Frontline documentary, I think like late last year, and it was like farming, like the brink, we're on the tipping point. I'm like, oh my God, you know, but I mean, to be honest, it's something that we don't talk about a whole lot, you know, even this year, the rains were really hard on lots of growers. Last year was the drought that we had that was like pretty significant. So we understand it's this cycle, because, you know, I think they say agriculture is like 25% contributions to like climate change, essentially. But the irony is that by contributing to climate change, these systems are probably the most vulnerable to climate change, because they're relying on fertilizer that is greenhouse gas produced to make those. They're relying on pesticides that are, one, causing, you know, irreparable harm to waterways and local ecosystems, but also they're developing, they're causing more resistant, like, pests and pathogens to form through their usage. So, and then, you know, herbicides are the same way. You know, we spray Roundup, but now there are Roundup resistant weeds now that are being dealt with all across the country. And, you know, this idea of crop monocultures where every crop is genetically the same and owned by, you know, one company. And that's, it's, you know, we're lucky that, you know, we're on the forefront of, you know, breeding for resistance to diseases, because that's a big implication down the line of, if all these crops are the same, then they can be hit by the same disease, essentially. So that's a worry that a lot of people have right now. And then on the far left, you know, working up the soil constantly. I mean, we see it here in Wisconsin, all around the Midwest. Soil erosion is sort of the untalked about issue, I think. And it's, you know, there's hasn't been really a net positive on soil, you know, for a long time. I mean, I'm from Oklahoma, and, you know, the Dust Bowl in the 1930s is still, you know, the reason why we can't farm productively in Oklahoma, essentially, and why I have to come up here to learn more about actual farming, essentially. But I think, you know, understanding that it's the big picture, but I think there is a lot of hope. I mean, if we look at a good example is forestry. The industry of forestry has been working a lot more with indigenous peoples in terms of like stuff like, in terms of like, you know, preserving species, dealing with fires, like fire ecology. So, and, you know, coastal indigenous peoples have been very integral in helping, you know, monitor marine populations for research and, you know, help our management practices. Farming is a whole different thing because it's this complex mesh of, you know, political, social, economic factors that really, you know, inhibit. We get the farm bill every like 5 or 6 years, basically, and that's the only chance we have to really change agricultural policy in this country. But, you know, it's just always, there's no real advocacy for like what, you know, we need to be doing. For example, we could be subsidizing other crops besides corn and soybean. For some farmers want to actually grow different crops, we can be building machinery that can actually better work with sustainable practices. And, you know, there's, so I'm not saying we all have to go out and, you know, replace the fields with Three Sisters or anything, but I think it's showing us that, you know, at one point things were done very differently on these very lands. And I think we can just probably be better informed by that, honestly. And, you know, like I said, I'm not advocating for anything super radical. It's just, you know, crops have, these same crops like corn and stuff have been grown here for centuries. And it was done a certain way. And I wonder why, because it worked. So, and I think that's sort of important to note. And so I think, practically speaking, how can you support, you know, indigenous farming efforts currently? The Intertribal Ag Council, if you go on their website, they have like a list of like indigenous producers and like people that are selling goods and produce, essentially. And then, you know, there's seed, especially here in the Midwest too, there's lots of seed keeping efforts in terms of like people who are actively trying to grow seeds, reconnect communities to their heirloom seed varieties, and also teach, you know, indigenous communities more about like their traditional food systems and how they sort of worked. And yeah, I think that's, yeah, that's it. I was rambling for a second. Thank you.
Stand right here with me. Sounds good. So, boy, I was really struck by how this presentation sure ties into one of the seven principles, the interconnectedness of life. So this is time for discussion. We have, you know, a little 5 to 7 minutes. I think everybody knows the drill. If you have a question, please come up on either side, come to the mic, or if you prefer, stand up and someone will bring a mic to you. And in asking our questions, we rely on our covenant of good relations to be sure that all voices are welcomed and relationships are valued. For the people who might be online, you can type a question into the chat and your question will be read. Okay, so just you can, people come up here.
They'll come up and ask a question. Okay. And you can, you want to sit or you stand, right?
Okay, I have a couple of questions. I've done the Three Sisters. This year didn't work so well because my squash got eaten, and some of the squash is way behind the corn. I'm wondering which, I'm fascinated, I've already got my cover crop planted for my potatoes that are done, but I'm fascinated with the idea of interplanting cover crops before you harvest. So I'd like to know which crops you've been doing that with. And then the second thing is, as a plant or pathologist, I had no potato bugs this year, which seemed really strange. Why did I have no potato bugs?
Okay, yeah, so for the cover crops, we have, like, that's like part of my research where I'm testing which ones work best. We have stuff like winter wheat, chicory and plantain, and clover. I think clover is a very popular one just because it's a legume and adds that nitrogen in the soil, essentially. But really, I mean, there's like these, you can go online and buy these really diverse mixtures and just plant it, and you get like a really nice, you know, I think one that we tried with one of the growers was like, it had like sunflower, Sudan grass, clover, like radishes. But yeah, radish is a very good one, actually. That, because like the deep roots help break apart the soil. And then, what was the other question?
Oh, potato bugs.
Oh, you must be doing something right then. I don't know, it could be maybe like the rain this year. That's like my only thought, I guess, but yeah. I don't know. Thank you.
Last year's drought.
Yeah, last year's drought.
Too. You questioners, so come on.
Quick question, John Wonderland. You mentioned soil health a couple of times. Do you have specific metrics that determines whether soil is healthy or not? And is it different for different types of crops?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So when people say soil health, it is kind of like a catch-all term. It depends on, like, again, like what you're growing. What, for example, for our group, they're really interested in just adding more nutrients and organic matter back to the soil. So that group at Oneida that I worked with, that was there yesterday, because the field they were working at before was farmed conventionally by wheat for like 10 years. So initially they got drained. So they're more focused on like rebuilding. That's the kind of trend I get. It's a lot of rebuilding soils, just adding nutrients, organic matter that's not particularly there. And then, but yeah, so soil health can be lots of different things. It could be just like, again, like more nutrients in there. It could just be resistance to diseases. Some soils are more resistant to diseases than other ones. And then, yeah, just looking at long-term sort of like soil, like nutrient health. And it does differ between crops because obviously crops have different nutrient requirements. But in the work that I do, it's particularly just like rebuilding soils, essentially. So those cover crops, when they get worked back in the soil, they help add in that nutrients, organic matter, essentially. And it's like, it's a long-term goal. You don't get immediate effects like within like 2 or 3 years usually for like soil stuff. So they're looking down the line for how they can improve their soil.
Kent Wenger, he, him. So I guess I have a comment and a question. The comment is sort of you talked a lot about or quite a bit about sort of how a lot of current agricultural practices are optimized for a pretty short term time scale. And I guess I feel like that is, in general, kind of one of the fundamental problems of our society, that sort of the way our economic system is set up sort of induces a short-term focus to a large extent. So I guess I just feel like that's a much bigger problem than just in agriculture. My question, just out of curiosity, is whether it's known whether the Three Sisters was discovered by a particular culture and then spread, or was it discovered by multiple cultures independently?
Yeah, that's a really good comment, Ken. My boss who works, he's organic extension, so he goes to the farmers and like works with them organic practices. I remember one time she mentioned to me, it's, you know, selling farmers, it's like selling these practices to farmers, you have to emphasize the money you'll save long term over like how much it costs now. And I remember that was like very impactful to me because it really made me think about that sort of short term. And in terms of the three sisters, so each crop, I believe, I'm trying to remember the order. I think, I want to say squash. I'm trying to remember this one. I read this paper like the other month. But yeah, so each crop, it wasn't all at once. Each crop was basically traded up north from Mexico, essentially, over the course of centuries. So at one point, it may not have, I think, like, when I'm, sort of got from like reading a lot of the accounts and everything was most likely it was, I think the Three Sisters was practiced though in Central America, in like Central America. So I'm pretty sure that practice was also like pushed up as well in the other groups. But at a certain point, like the crops did come like sort of more individually at a certain time. Cause I know like corn appeared here in like the Midwest. Like at one point, and then beans and then squash came afterwards. I'm assuming that knowledge probably came with it as well. And even like, and but yeah, it's pretty much like unanimous. Even like really, even like the really early like cultures like Cahokia near St. Louis, the like the ancient indigenous like metropolis, they utilized the Three Sisters, and that was like around like 1100 AD, I believe.
Hi, this is Dirk, and just had a question which may or may not be quick, but I grew up in northern Indiana, not too far from Michigan, and was right in the Corn Belt. You probably lived in the area long enough along I-80, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa. It wasn't corn back in the day, and so I don't know if you have any thoughts about shifting all of that back to or what it might be, so it isn't like you described.
Yeah, I think it was like something in like the 70s or 80s, I believe, where like they really shifted really heavily into like the ethanol and like commodity space, essentially, to where like they just wanted like to really like invest in corn. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, I think the main thing is giving growers the options. And like, cause I think, you know, being a farmer right now is very difficult. Cause I mean, you're just sort of stuck in this balance of like, you know, one really bad year of bad crops can break you. And then, you know, a good year, you're pretty much kind of breaking even. So I think it's really just, you know, not telling them what they can grow, but just giving them the options. Cause I'm sure there's, you know, plenty of things that farmers would want to grow or be interested in doing and selling and what entering new markets or, you know, even staying in corn. But, you know, it's just, I think it's just because it's so heavily subsidized now and no other crop besides corn, soybean, wheat or whatever is subsidized essentially. And so it's almost like a lot, you have to really go in and have like your market already set up, your provider, your buyer already set up, and just really have that ready. And like even vegetables too are really risky, honestly, and more like corn and soybeans are bred to be a little more hardier, but vegetables can be, are a little more susceptible to diseases and other things like that as well.
Thanks so much again, Daniel, for your interesting presentation. And I know we had at least one question, and Daniel said he can stick around for a few minutes after we complete the service if you have more questions for him. And I'll just take a minute to say that I think this is just such a beautifully planned and targeted service for this time of year and the subject matter. Everybody who worked on it, which was very little me, just the voice, but is really well done. So today we are going to be sharing our offering with the CART Room for this quarter. It's a collaboration between families that have been homeless, Orchard Ridge, UCC, and the Road Home. And the money we collect for that is used for rental assistance. And our music for the offertory is Autumn Ballad by Nancy Farber, performed by Tuppence.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tuppence. The closing words for today's service are by Andrew Pakula, read by Barb Chatterton.
May you know fully and deeply the blessings of each of your heart's seasons, the inward turning of winter, springtime's lush renewal, the effortless steady growth of summer, and autumn's rich harvest. May your passage from season to season be blessed, eased by hands to hold and by the light of love to guide you on.
Thanks, Barb. We have closing music next, which is number 134 in the Gray Songbook, Our World is One, accompanied by Tuppence, Please Rise as You're Able, in Body or Spirit. Check your order of service as well. Next Sunday, we will not have a service because we will be at our annual retreat at Bethel Horizons. If questions about that, you can always ask Renee or Nancy or there's somebody else I know who's been real active in that. In another 2 weeks, we'll be back here at Prairie, and Reverend Ralph, our very own, is presenting, and after the service, we'll have a potluck lunch. There's also a potluck dinner this evening, September 26th. Thursday. What day did I say? Sunday? Thursday, September 26th. Here. Okay. And I see no other last-minute announcements, so we will be stopping our recording of this service at this point.